Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to the Talking Markets podcast series here on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. Joining me for the conversation today, very timely to have with us Brian Levitt, a Chief Global Market Strategist and Head of Strategy and Insights at Invesco. Brian, thank you for joining us. We're recording here on Monday, March 2nd. As mentioned, very timely that you're spending some time with our listeners, our clients. Great to have you back here with us on Market Moves, Brian.
My pleasure, Dan. Thank you.
So, Brian, as mentioned, and we are recording on Monday, March 2nd, coming off of the weekend, a lot of developments out of the Middle East remains a very fluid situation. A lot can take place in the days and weeks ahead. But as we're recording today, Brian, can you provide our listeners, our clients, with your thoughts, reflections on what has taken place in the context of the markets and thoughts on how markets have been responding in these early days?
I would say the markets have been generally sanguine so far, so let's see where this goes. But a couple of points to make. The first is, historically, markets have tended to perform fine in the 12 months following these types of events. So we shouldn't have a knee-jerk reaction that because this is happening that the markets are going to sell off. And if you want to look back to 91 with the first Persian Gulf War, or 2003 with the war between the U.S. and Iraq, in both instances, the markets were positive 12 months later. The other thing I would say is that you always want to look at it from the perspective of whether the event that's taking place will meaningfully change the trajectory of the global economy or will change what the U.S. Fed is going to do. Iran is a relatively small economy. They are not a significant exporter of oil to the world anymore. Most of their exports are going to China, if not all of them. Now, if the Strait of Hormuz is closed for a while, a lot of the world's oil does pass through there. You could, in your mind, get to a place where economic activity globally could be hindered, but I'm not ready to go there by any stretch of the imagination. I think it's way too soon to know that. And ultimately, again, Iran being a relatively small economy, I'm not willing to change my positive views for risk assets given this recent event, or despite this recent event.
Well, thank you, Brian, for that assessment. And as you mentioned, we'll see how this evolves in the days and weeks ahead. I do want to come back stateside if we focus in on the U.S. economy for a few moments. We're now speaking in the latter part of Q1. How would you assess the current health of the U.S. economy? What might be some areas of strain, concern, and what are your expectations for growth as we progress through the balance of 2026?
The economy is reasonably healthy. And if you go through the old GDP equation of C plus I plus G, the C being the consumer, particularly at the middle and upper ends, quite strong. Household net worth is at or near an all-time high, and the consumers in the aggregate are not over-levered. They haven't borrowed too much. So that's good. The I, business investment, we know this one, right? We've heard what Alphabet and Amazon and Meta and others have said on their earnings calls about the future investment in AI. So that continues to work. And then the G is government spending, which isn't going to be huge, but you do get the benefits of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, whether that's the no tax on tips or the expectation of higher tax rebates or accelerated depreciation. So you put all that together and then also add on top of it a Federal Reserve that wants to and is likely to lower interest rates. That creates a good nominal backdrop for the U.S. In fact, one where we actually see activity for leading indicators picking up even from where they are right now.
So just running with the Fed for a few more moments, at UBS, our chief investment office is calling for two additional cuts throughout the course of 2026. What policy changes, Brian, do you expect from the Fed, and how do you expect monetary policy to perhaps change or adjust under expected new leadership later in the spring?
Two cuts would get you to about 3% by the end of the year, which seems very reasonable. Call it a target rate of 3 to 3.25. I would view that as neutral policy right now, given the flattish shape of the yield curve. I would view the Fed as being a little bit restrictive. So moving towards a more neutral rate, given where we are, seems appropriate. there's no reason to be overly restrictive with price stability, with inflation expectations contained. We will see with regards to the new Fed chair, the market does not expect and did not price in a significant change in expectations from when it was Jerome Powell to when it seemed like it would be Kevin Hassert to now that it's Kevin Warsh. The market's expectations for a 3% funds rate by the end of the year largely remained intact, and inflation expectations remained contained. So what I've been telling investors is, you know, watch the inflation break-evens, because if there is a hint that the Fed is losing independence, you'll see inflation expectations breaking out. That hasn't been the case. Again, it's, you know, the 3 to 5 year U.S. Treasury break-evens are sitting somewhere in the 2.5 area. So that's very well contained, and a market that is, you know, priced for 3%. And given that it's priced for 3% on the Fed funds rate, I think the Fed's going to take the opportunity to get us there.
Now, in addition to monetary policy, investors have closely been monitoring AI disruption, seemingly one of the bigger market stories as of late, albeit geopolitical concerns. We covered that already. But if we focus in on AI disruption, with most of the focus being on the company or business model level, what macro implications, Brian, do you expect from AI, and how soon could they occur?
Artificial intelligence build-out will continue, and so there is substantial investment remaining, and if you are part of that build-out, that should continue to benefit you. So whether that is memory chips, semiconductors, industrial businesses, that should all continue to be benefited. A little bit of a challenge accruing to the so-called hyperscalers who are spending the money, because, of course, those types of businesses are going from where they were almost had monopolistic characteristics with light investment to they're all competing in similar spaces and investing significantly. So a little bit of a headwind for them. Now, with regards to what has happened in the software industry since the beginning of this year, you know, you have to remember that we came into the year with investors concerned about valuations and software as a whole trading at 35 times forward earnings, and investors didn't seem to like that. And yet now that they've repriced to around market valuations, investors don't seem to like that either. Obviously, the you know, a 20-30% down in that index is not fun to live through. But I would say they're appropriately valued now at market level. There will be disruption in the software as a service space over time, although I think in the near term the market is overstating it. If you listen to businesses outside of AI, what you hear is a lot of business executives still trying to get their arms around it, still trying to determine how they're going to deploy it, still determining whether they're automating processes or augmenting their employees. So I think we're still in early days. I wouldn't bet on, you know, I think you actually probably start to see software bottoming here. We will go through some volatility in different industries as we assess what the AI build means for different parts of the economy and the markets. But ultimately, I think AI is going to benefit markets in aggregate rather than hinder them significantly.
Now, sticking maybe with thematics, what's top of mind for Invesco in 2026 as it relates to general investment themes?
Improvement in global economic activity. Now, Dan, I know that's a little bit hard to say with bombs flying in the Middle East right now, but if you just take a step back and you look, you're in an environment where most of the world is working to stimulate economic activity. You've already seen substantially lower rates in Europe, in UK, a lowering of rates, in Japan, a fiscal spend, in the US, lower rates. China's worked to stimulate their economy. I think there's more to do, and I suspect that they will do it. So in general, what you have is easier policy globally. And so if you're going to bet against improving economic activity and you're going to bet against better performance from cyclical parts of the market, smaller capitalization, value, you're in essence betting against the policymakers globally. Historically, that has not been a great place to be. So our theme is this, you know, on what we've been talking about since October is a broadening out of markets, which has certainly been playing out. And for U.S. investors to look outside the borders of the United States, given that the U.S. dollar is likely to moderate further here as the U.S. Federal Reserve lowers interest rates towards the rest of the world.
So maybe let's turn now to asset allocation views, Brian, and we'll hit a few asset classes, beginning with equities. What are your thoughts in terms of size, style, sector preferences?
Optimistic on equities, improving economic activity and easier policy tends to favor smaller capitalization businesses. You've already seen a pretty decent run in small caps. I think mid caps are in a very nice space. You've not seen a run up to the extent that you've seen in small valuations look attractive. So we do like moving down in capitalization. Mid caps look quite appropriate. At the at the broad index level, a preference for equal weight over market cap weight with regards to the S&P 500. And then, we had talked about a favoring of cyclical sectors as well as non-U.S. dollar assets, and particularly the emerging markets. If you look historically, when the U.S. is easing, what that has meant is a weaker dollar. You can go back 50 years and look at which part of the market, which region has performed best in a weaker dollar environment, and that is, in fact, emerging market equities.
And then what about on the fixed income side?
The fixed income side is more challenged given where valuations are. But given our optimistic view on the global economy, you continue to be in credit. I recognize that spreads are tight. The challenge is that spreads can remain tight for a while. Spreads tend to blow out when the economy rolls over. You get some inflation. The Fed has to raise rates. That's when you tend to see spreads blow out, not when the economy is doing well and the Fed is easing. So we would continue to look to the credit markets. We would continue to look to the municipal bond market in order to generate yield above what is currently provided at the money market level or U.S. Treasuries. In fact, we think U.S. Treasuries got overbought. Seeing U.S. a 10-year below 4%, that seemed overbought to me, and I would expect U.S. Treasury bonds yields to back up here. Not substantially, but to back up here.
And then curious to hear your thoughts on commodities, precious metals, gold, silver in particular, just given the attention those assets have been receiving lately, the run-up in prices. What are your thoughts on gold, silver at these levels? What kind of role can they play in a portfolio?
I would always view them as a hedge against certain risks in a portfolio. I do worry that right now investors may be a little caught up in the momentum trade in gold. If you look at year-over-year percent change in demand for gold, it's not coming from the jewelry business. We know central bankers are investing in gold, but year-over-year, it's actually negative, right? So they've invested a lot, but the rate of change is slowing. And so where it's really coming from is demand. It's really coming from retail flows. So I would be mindful. You know, the momentum trade could go on for a while, but you know, at some point, you're looking at gold that's trading at 5 or 6 standard deviations to its average on price. So that's quite a move. So I would just be somewhat cautious on that.
Well, Brian, you've covered a lot of ground today for our listeners, our clients. Anything in the way of final thoughts, takeaways, or anything you would like to reinforce before we close out?
My most important takeaway would be for investors to manage their emotions and to think through with a long-term historical perspective and context through these tumultuous days. We've lived through an awful lot. Just think about what the 20th century brought. Just think about what the first 25, 26 years has given us already in this century. Always a lot of things going on. The markets tend to move through it. And I suspect this time will be no different.
Well, Brian, always a pleasure. Thank you for dedicating the time today to be with our listeners, our clients, sharing with them your insights on a wide range of timely topics and the guidance when it comes to positioning. So looking forward to picking back up with our conversation at some point. Brian, though, thank you again for spending some time today with our listeners and clients here on the Talking Markets podcast.
It was my pleasure. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG, member FINRA SIPC.